are.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, September is really into full swing. And this is the first week of September. It means this Friday is the first Friday. There are many First Friday type events happening across our listening area, including First Friday open mic at the Western Sullivan Public Library's Delaware Free Branch in Calicoon. We have an interview with their featured speaker coming up this Friday, and it's Sullivan County Poet Laureate Kevin Graham in the second half of the program. We have a very big report for our feature story tonight, so let's just get right on into it. Because folks who have incarcerated family members are saying that they face real barriers when they try to maintain connections with their loved ones. They also say that when they visit, they experience the same feelings of humiliation and powerlessness that those behind bars say they experience. And worse, they say that both of these things are especially true since the statewide Wildcat Corrections strike earlier this year. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim investigated these issues for us. She spoke with family members of incarcerated individuals as well as advocates for those families.
Entering a correctional facility as a visitor was not made to be easy. Loved ones of incarcerated individuals are forced to pass through an intensive screening process consisting of a metal detector, a canine dog, and now a body image scanner effective March 2025. But for Candace Miller, a Bronx resident who is currently 71 years old and has been routinely visiting her son at Fishkill Correctional Facility, she was met with unexpected challenges from correctional officers during a recent trip on August 2nd that ultimately resulted in her leaving the facility without a visit.
So I went through the first scanner, so the scanner went off. All those people there, I never saw them before. They were like brand new. I said, no, you just beeped. So you have to go back through. So I went back through, and they said, no, you have to take your wig off. So I said, take my wig off? Girl, before me, they made her take her wig off, but they gave her the decency to go in the bathroom and take her wig off. So I took the wig off. She said, because as long as you don't clear the scanner, you cannot go through. I mean, you cannot have a visit. So I said, okay, I'll take the wig off. So I want my visit.
Although she's been told to take off her wig during past visits, Miller said in an interview with Radio Catskill that she's never been forced to do so publicly and always gone to the bathroom accompanied by a female officer when asked. But even after having to take her wig off and eventually even her hairnet, in which she had resorted to wearing a plastic bag to cover her bare head, the scanner continued to beep. Confused as to what was setting the machine off, Miller, who has scoliosis, raised the possibility that...
So I said, oh, there was a correction officer standing next to me, next to the lock. I said, oh, maybe it's the pain patches I had on. Oh, why did I say that? Oh, I got something started all over again. And they said, you cannot wear no pain patches in here. You cannot wear a back. No, they said, you cannot wear that brace in here. But the brace has been cleared. I mean, I didn't try to sneak it in. I placed it through the scanner so you can clear it to let you see there was nothing in it. I just need it for support.
And Miller is not alone in her experience with officers. Sophia Elijah, former executive director of the Correctional Association of New York and founder of the Alliance of Families for Justice, a nonprofit dedicated to empowering families of incarcerated folks, explained that family members often do the time with their incarcerated loved ones but suffer in silence, which includes being subject to the same position of powerlessness that their loved ones behind bars face when visiting but also beyond.
Harassment by COs is common. It's been common for as long as I've been visiting prisons, which is over 50 years, and I'm sure it far preceded that. Family members are constantly being humiliated. Their dignity is not being recognized. I mean, similarly, their incarcerated loved ones are humiliated all the time. It is generally believed and accepted by guards that they don't have to recognize the humanity of people who are incarcerated or their family members. Now, of course, there are some guards who don't think that way, so I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but unfortunately the general culture in the prisons is that incarcerated people and their family members have no human rights or dignity.
Miller's story comes amid the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, otherwise known as DOCS, instituting body image scanners as a step in the screening process. The scanners were conditions set by striking officers during the correctional officer strike from February of this year, who cited ongoing issues with contraband as their reason. In the past 3 years, a wave of restrictions have been put into place on families. Regular mail has to be photocopied, and any packages for inmates must come from approved vendors. But contraband has also been shown to be a major issue among correctional officers who do not have to walk through scanners to enter the facilities. The issue with the body scanners in particular is their high sensitivity, or rather invasiveness. Miller described witnessing other women crying in exasperation for being falsely accused of carrying contraband after scanners detected them wearing menstrual products, including tampons and pads. Both Elijah and Tanya Krupat, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the criminal justice reform nonprofit Osborne Association, said they've also been hearing stories of menstrual products as well as medical implants being marked as contraband and loved ones subsequently being denied their visit.
And so, if I need to be graphic, I will. If a woman is wearing a sanitary napkin or a tampon, the body scanner picks that up. And what has been happening more and more frequently is if the body scanner picks that up, then the person is told that they cannot visit because the body scanner picked that up. Now, if a woman is on her menses or going through menopause, she has to wear one or more of those items. And then she's told she cannot visit. We've actually had incidents where a woman has offered to remove either the sanitary napkin or the tampon, which obviously is not desirable when you're sitting in a visit. And the guard has said, you can remove it, but you're not going to be allowed to go in.
Even after correctional officers had identified her wedding ring as the culprit for the beeping, Miller was called uncooperative and was unable to pass, leading her to walk out of the facility out of frustration. This is when she saw a state trooper, who she believed the correctional officers had called on her, walking towards the door when three officers rushed out to meet him, saying she's already left.
Some people will drive you insane in that place. The things that they do to people is just inhumane. And also, if they're treating us this way, how are they treating our loved ones?
Following the incident, Miller did file a written complaint regarding her visit on August 2nd, which has since been forwarded to the superintendent's office of Fishkill Correctional Facility. Upon Radio Catskill's request to DOCS for comment on her experience, they denied that Miller was forced to take her wig off and instead voluntarily informed correctional staff that she had a wig on and removed it based on their preliminary investigation and review of video footage. They also responded that the New York State Police was not involved in any capacity during the altercation, but they did not respond to the specific allegations regarding Miller being yelled at for wearing a back brace and pain patches, nor women being turned away for wearing menstrual products. Radio Catskill was not able to independently verify the statement before airtime, but has filed a FOIL request for the video footage in question. Nonprofit organizations like Osborne Association, however, have worked to support families throughout this process. In partnership with DOCS, they run 19 hospitality centers in New York State for families to mentally and physically prepare for visiting, which includes taking care of potential issues such as dress code or proper documentation beforehand. But since the correctional officer strike, visiting for maximum security facilities have remained limited to the weekends and or one day of the week, meaning longer lines for families, overcrowded conditions inside facilities, and shorter visits with loved ones. Krupat said the visiting experience has become that much more stressful for both families and correctional officers, which can then border on hostile.
The visitor experiences can be incredibly stressful. I think right now there's the added stressors with staffing changes, new policies, overcrowding. So the tensions are, I imagine, even higher than normal. There isn't really time necessarily for problem solving. I can imagine some officers, if you have a long line, you're more likely to just, you know, deny a visit and move on because you've got lots of people waiting than if visits are spread out over 7 days and it's not overcrowded, you can work with an individual visitor a little more and have more patience. also the tensions if officers aren't trained, are new to the post, overcrowding. All of these are kind of the ingredients for very stressful, even confrontational interactions.
But Elijah argues that experiences like Miller's are much deeper than just the correctional officer strike and its reverberating impacts. Instead, they are inherent to two major dynamics that underline the New York State prison system.
One is that all the power rests with the guards. All the power rests with the guards. And the people who are incarcerated and their family members are subject to the whim and abuse of power by the guards. In New York State, you have an additional dynamic. In New York State, the overwhelming majority of the prisons are located in upstate New York. And the demographics in upstate New York is generally lacking in any significant numbers of Black and brown people. The criminal justice system is racist, and a disproportionate number of Black and brown people have their lives interrupted by the criminal justice system and are incarcerated. You visit any prison in New York State, you will find an overwhelming number of Black and Latinx people in those prisons. So you have the guards in these prisons are overwhelmingly from all white communities, and they have absolute power over incarcerated people who are overwhelmingly from Black and Latinx communities. And so you mix in racism because the guards, by and large, have had no contact with Black and brown people except in their job setting. So they don't have any level of respect, and they are dining on a daily of racism. So that combination of racism and absolute power results in further obliteration of any modicum of respect for the dignity of the humanity of the people who are incarcerated and their family members. The things that guards say and do to visitors, who are most of the time women, they wouldn't dare say to their mothers, sisters, grandmothers, aunties, or daughters.
And for Doris Chavis, a social worker living in Rochester whose oldest son has been incarcerated at Wyoming Correctional Facility for about 2 years now, this power imbalance has manifested into a culture of fear. On a visit with her daughter, Chavis recalled an officer rudely remarking on her daughter's leggings as she was passing through the metal detector and feeling, at that moment, that she could do nothing.
I went through first, and I was getting ready to go into the scanner, and my daughter was going through the metal detector, and he said very, very rudely, "I'm not letting you in wearing those pants. You're not going in there." And it's like, she's a child. Her mother is here. I wasn't happy, but I could have spoken up and said something in a respectful manner, but it doesn't matter because they don't like to be challenged. So he would have probably, and I don't want to assume, but I'm just going to take a wild guess and say he probably would have taken me addressing him as me being disrespectful or defiant or whatever, and either A, took my visit, or B, retaliate against my son. And no family should feel like that. I should not have fear to speak up for my minor child in a respectable manner out of fear of retaliation against my loved one whom they have the power and control over. Because even if he would have sent me home, it would have sucked. But I would have been okay. I would have came back the next week. But what if he wouldn't have sent me home and would have later on that day, my son would have been the next Robert Brooks.
And the actual screening process is just one part of the fight loved ones have to navigate without any support from the system. Even getting to the facility in the first place is a major issue for many families. Richard Seller, a mill worker living in Lewis County whose wife has been incarcerated at Bedford Hills, said it takes about 4 hours to get to the facility from where he lives. Although he has not personally faced any harassment from officers, he described the fatigue of driving for 8 hours round trip on top of gas expenses, which makes it physically taxing for him and his three children to see their mother. For others, specifically elderly people, it can be physically impossible, meaning their loved ones miss out on these connections. But Sellers said he finds a sense of powerlessness also creeping its way into the smaller moments. When docs flagged a video of his son throwing discus at a high school track meet from being sent to his wife. When items in the packages the family sends to Bedford Hills are consistently lost. When bureaucratic inefficiencies meant his family wasn't able to visit his wife on her birthday.
So Bedford, half the alphabet goes on Saturday, half the alphabet goes on Sunday, and then it flips the following weekend. Her birthday was a Saturday, so I called her counselor and got an exemption because we have to drive from so far away. We drove 4 hours down there to see her, and we walked in, and the person in visitation said, today's not her day, and I said, I have an exemption. I called the counselor, Mr. Dice, and everything should be all set, and they're like, oh, yep, let us go look. He never filed the paperwork. So we spent 8 hours on the road, over $100 in gas and tolls, and never got to see her on her birthday. She was in tears. My son was pushing me out of the visitation room because I was, I don't know if I was belligerent, but I was definitely upset and irate that, you know, all that wasted time and money.
This is despite the fact that visiting has proven to promote growth, Krupa explained, helping maintain connection between incarcerated individuals and their families, especially for children of incarcerated parents. New York does have the proximity law, effective since 2021, that requires parents to be incarcerated as close to their minor children as possible. And a bill focused on reestablishing inmates' rights to see their families in person 7 days a week and maintain regular communication with them is currently sitting in a Senate committee.
Focus, and my focus for more than 20 years professionally, has specifically been on the impact on children and how important visiting is. So if you think of, you know, phone calls are important, letters are important, email is important, but visiting is the only way to speak with, see, and touch your parent. It's for younger children. There's so much of the relationship that's not verbal even. It's the only way to be reassured that your parent is actually okay, to see them, to have important conversations. There's certain information that is just difficult to share over the phone, conversations that families need to have, decision-making, whether it's related to children, moving, school, medical decisions, all kinds of things that come up that are sensitive, that people really need time.
Especially during the strike, Seller found himself suffering from anxiety attacks due to the overwhelming uncertainty of whether or not his wife was okay. Chavis described a similar fear after she had to tirelessly fight for answers after her son's lung collapsed, having only been notified of his placement at Wyoming County Hospital after another incarcerated individual had told her husband.
I don't feel like I've received any support. No. It's so many different levels of brokenness between these systems that it should, no, I can't even put it in words, but no, I literally do not. No, this is, these systems are beyond broken. And it's sad. It's sad that there is research out there to show what could lessen our recidivism rates in the U.S. refuses to follow other countries' leads. It's sad. And that's all I can say about that.
I just spoke with families of incarcerated individuals alongside Sophia Elijah of the Alliance of Families for Justice and Tanya Krupat of the Osborne Association on the experience of incarceration from the perspective of loved ones. In Liberty, I'm Julia Kim for Radio Catskill.
And thank you so much, Julia Kim, for that report.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Yes, it is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And once again, just so we're all clear, it is a new month. It's now September. You can check your calendar. And one of the things that that means is this Friday is the first Friday of the new month. So First Friday events are coming, and Sullivan County Poet Laureate Kevin Graham will be the featured performer at Open Mic First Fridays at the Western Sullivan Public Library's Delaware Free Branch. That's in Calicoon. Graham is a poet, musician, and a visual artist, and he's planning an improvised performance that blends live looping guitar with spoken poetry. Patricio Robayo spoke to Kevin Graham recently, and they started off with an update on what Kevin's been up to as Poet Laureate since they last spoke.
That's been the main thing, is the poetry workshops, and I've channeled most of my energy into that. So between writing poetry for that, participating in the assignments that I give in that workshop, and thinking about what to do for the next workshop, but also been writing a lot about creativity and productivity sort of theory and techniques and things like that. And, right. You know, the poetry workshop, in air quotes, I'd say it's taken more of a shape of like a poetry support group, maybe like a creativity support group, just where we get together, we talk about, first of all, we share poetry for sure, and we support each other in that, but we also talk about just the creative process and, you know, the sort of obstacles that could be there in productivity and work through that.
And that can be definitely helpful for artists.
Absolutely.
I just take it back, like my artistic history, I was in photography, and the most fun experience I had was I joined this group down in the city in Chelsea. It was basically just a critique group. We would just sit around with one of the gallery owners and we put our work up and work on the wall and just sit around and talk about the work. We could be very hard sometimes to be vulnerable as new work and you're unsure about it. But it's a process you have to go through. I'm assuming that's how it is with poetry.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, poetry, just to speak on that real quick for a second, like in terms of my philosophy and what we do in the group, you know, we focus on the positive stuff and not in that sort of kind of cliche way. I just feel like when somebody's creating something or writing down a piece of poetry, they're thinking about it, they're laboring over it or whatever. It's important to them and it means something to them and they're trying to have an impact of some kind. And so I think that you could approach it a couple different ways. You can talk about what's not good about it, what's not working, what's sort of clunky about it. Or you can talk about what you really like about it. And when there's a group of people and a few people are saying the same thing they like about it, that makes you feel good and realize like, oh, hey, that line worked. These lines worked. Or maybe the whole poem worked. People just really love the thing. Or you can tell by people's reactions. I don't think that it's totally necessary, especially in a sort of casual setting where you don't really know people super deep yet and their creative, you know, what they're trying to get across creatively. You know, I think it leaves space for them to look back at their work and look at what worked and what didn't work in a way that enhances confidence as opposed to sort of squashes it. So that's my philosophy.
Yeah. No, definitely. Do you do any kind of sort of start off the workshop with some kind of like free writing at first?
Oh,
sort of
warm up? You know, I start off my workshop most recently, the last bunch of them, talking about something I've been thinking about. Usually it's a lot of dead air in the beginning. Mm. People are just kind of like showing up. It's on Zoom, by the way. And any of this can be found on Sullivan County Poet Laureate on Instagram and Facebook. I always post when that's happening. It's every 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks in the summer it's been, but I open up just by talking about something I'm thinking about. And last time I was talking about significant moments and these moments in our memory that seem to stick. So I talk about that a little bit and I talk about how that relates to writing and creativity and what we can, you know, do to try to make our product more impactful in a way. And then after the group, I'll tend to write some sort of essay about it so you can kind of revisit what I was talking about a little more in depth. And that's something that is also being posted on my Substack, nice. Kevin Graham, too. Okay. So you can go read some of that stuff, just sort of creativity and productivity, philosophy, life stuff. But I think it's all intertwined.
Right. And so I just want to go to this Friday. This is the first time you're doing this type of open mic thing for the Calicoan Library or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's their first Fridays mm-hmm. event or whatever it is. And they do it the first Friday of every month during the sort of mild seasons, spring, right. Summer, fall. And I don't think they do it for a few months in the winter. I'm not really sure. And yeah, so they'll have an open mic. Sign ups at 5:45. The open mic's from 6 to 7. And then they have a feature performer from 7 to 8. And so this Friday, right. I am that feature performer.
And how does that feel too? I mean, is this the first time you're melding poetry and music together or?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, you know, I've only played solo once with the loop setup, this looper setup, but that was all rehearsed. And I had some lyrics. I did some singing with that too, but also just instrumental, but it was all rehearsed. This is the first time ever. And I've been playing for a long time and doing the looping thing for a long time. And I say long time, I'm like 20 plus years,
right.
You know?
Wow.
That I've ever played this improvised thing, looping thing out live, which is, I'm suspiciously not nervous about it, but it's a little bit, it's simultaneously freeing and constrictive and scary in a way to not have any plan or any idea what I'm going to play.
Did they know that you did this type of thing, the looping and the poetry thing, or did they just wanted you as a regular featured person and expected you to read poetry from 7 to 8?
they're kind of open with what you do. And I, you know, this may be the first they're hearing of what I'm going to do on Friday, because this is kind of like developed over the last week that I'm going to do this. So my initial idea was that I had like a week and a half ago was that, all right, I'm going to do this looping thing. I'm going to improvise a piece of music and then read poetry over it and improvise music in between and kind of thinking about it like a film score for the poetry. But I'm improvising the music. Poetry is written, so I'm not improvising any poetry. That's all written stuff that I've written over the last few years mainly. I'm not really going too deep. And yeah, we'll see where it goes. I mean, I have at this point kind of a couple different styles of poetry. Some stuff's a little bit more existential and melancholy, and some stuff's a little bit more abstract and playful. You know, depending on whatever loop I come up with or piece of music I come up with, and I'll read that kind of poetry with it. And
so it'll be spontaneous looping. Like, you know, you're not going to have a pre-programmed music, not really pre-programmed, but an idea of what you're going to play.
No, other than that I have my own subconscious cliches, which I'm definitely not going to resist, because I'm going to need to pull from something when I'm standing or sitting in front of a crowd.
How much do you think that changes sort of the mood or the vibe of a poem? Because, you know, someone who reads a poem without seeing it read out loud can have a different sort of pacing, can have a different sort of vibe in their mind when they read a poem. And you're sort of putting your music stamp on it and saying, hey, no, you got to feel this.
I mean, that's a good point, because it actually completely changes the pacing of the reading. Because I'll make this loop and I'm kind of fitting the poem now in between sections that feel like something. So, you know, where the poem is written, I am also improvising and sort of molding around this improvised music, you know, how I'm reading it, how I'm delivering it, how I'm like splitting it up, which is different than how I just read it straight. You know, I think with any of the poetry, I think for me, especially when I'm hearing poetry with my ADD and whatever, it's hard for me to remember or process what people are saying. So I tend to like emphasize for people to read slower, and I try to read slower when I'm reading poetry, just so that people can hear it. And this is even, in a way, much slower. It's almost lyrical, but I'm not singing it. But it fits into the music in that way.
What do you want to give us an example?
Yeah, sure.
Poems.
Yeah. Oh, poems. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hardest thing to do. Think about nothing. I try to think my thinking into a plum and throw it into the thorn bush. But it always reappears in my throat, full of ants. I grab my own hand with earthworm fingers to pull myself into the sun. But it sets faster than I can run. And the worms, they plunge down into the soil like roots, waiting for the moon wash the air with danger. My dreams, I'm always wide awake. Watching from who I was before I learned what me is supposed to be.
That was Craven Graham. He's performing at the Calicoon Library on September 5th on a Friday at the open free mic session, open
First Fridays
First Fridays
event thing.
Yeah.
Feature artist.
Well, Kevin, again, thank you so much for joining us here. I do appreciate it. It was unique. It was different. I did really love the performance of this poetry and music there. So check out Kevin on Friday at the Calicum Library. Again, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you so much, Patricio Robayo, for that report. Thank you for listening. That's it for the local edition. I'll be back again tomorrow. We'll talk to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union. For now, stay with us. We have more news from the Daily. This is Radio.